This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We will be here for the next 2 hours answering your questions of a nostalgic nature and plenty of nostalgia that we're looking at right now. The vintage cars that were on display for Community Day in the garage area are now being towed back to the area where they're kept, and they will be going on the track on Friday afternoon, shortly after the pit stop contest is over. But we've just seen Roger Ward's 1963 fourth place finisher go by, and one that I had never seen before. I knew it had been done recently. And that's the Johnny Thompson pole car from 1959, the shocking pink laydown, and that was just towed by a little tractor or little vehicle of some kind. I wasn't looking at the vehicle, I was looking at the car, because that was great to see that. I had never seen that car. But anyway, so that's been quite a sight, and we're going to be here for the next almost 2 hours taking your questions of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. And we already have John on the line from Columbia Station. Good afternoon, John. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Donald.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Beautiful day here in Ohio. I presume the same in Indiana.
Yes, it's lovely because there's no track activity. It's always gorgeous when there's no track activity. Where exactly is Columbia Station, by the way?
It's southwest of Cleveland.
Oh, you're up away then.
Southwest of Cleveland in northeast Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a semi-rural area. Last night, your recap of the 65 race, you mentioned Parnelli coming close to running out of fuel at the end.
Mm-hmm.
The following day, his car owner, A.C. Agajanian, of course,
mm-hmm.
received a $50 fine from USAC
for
what I guess we would call a pit infraction, and I thought you might want to comment on that, and then I had a follow-up.
Okay, I think you mean that he sat up on top of the fuel tank for a better view.
Right.
Yeah, and he got fined $50.
Yeah, something about behavior inappropriate in the pit area or something. My follow-up was, it's my understanding that until 1947, the driver was required to exit from the car during the pit stops.
That's correct.
And I wondered if you could comment on, number one, if that was for safety reasons. Actually, my wife asked that question, and I said I wasn't sure because early on, pit stops were primarily for tire changes.
Yes.
But I also wondered if you could just comment on at least what you know about changes in the rules associated with pit stops from the early days.
Oh, good heavens. That's pretty open-ended. A couple of things. First of all, somebody suggested to me that I should have said that 65 was the first real year for tire wars with Firestone and Goodyear. In fact, Goodyear was there in 64, and they had several drivers under contract, but they also had an escape clause that if they didn't feel that they were ready by a certain time, which I think was sometime before the first qualifying day, that they would release all of their contract drivers to go ahead and run on Firestones, and that happened. And but in 65, they were around to stay, and the field was, I'd say, an even split. It couldn't be because it's 33. But there was 16 of one and 17 of the other, and I forget which one had the edge, but I should mention that. And then also, another thing is that I was mistaken on this myself for many years. I thought that after 64 that you couldn't use gasoline. To be more blunt, that gasoline was banned. I would prefer to say it was no longer permitted. Well, it turns out that that's not true, and they got around just flat no longer allowing it by coming up with this very special rule. They wanted to at least encourage the use of methanol, And the thing about gas was it would, the good thing was that it gave you better mileage. The bad thing was that it had a much lower flash point. In other words, it would ignite easier and cause fires, which we saw happen several times. So anyway, there was in 64 and earlier, there was no mandatory number of pit stops. So if you wanted to try and go without a stop, you could. And they, in 1965, they did a couple of things. One of them was that they put in two mandatory stops. And I was wrong on this for years. You could still use gasoline, but the thinking was that if you had to stop twice and you were required to hook up the refueling mechanism, you may as well go ahead and use methanol because you're going to have to stop twice anyway. And so anyway, Parnelli Jones and Johnny Paulson and Agajanian in between them, probably Johnny Paulson's recommendation or with Parnelli's agreement, they decided to do a mix. And they ran a mix of methanol and gasoline, and they felt they were down on power all day. And Agajanian said after the race that he said, well, we won't do that again. We were down on power. We had to stop twice. We may just as well have used methanol. And that apparently was the idea behind the rule. So after, and I don't know if anybody else did a mix, but they certainly did to get second. And then after that, then nobody would use gasoline, although, and eventually you couldn't use it, but for a while you could, and nobody chose to for the reasons that I've just mentioned. As far as getting out of the car, I suppose that was for safety reasons. I never really thought about it, so your wife has raised a good point. But certainly when you said to change tires, I mean, refueling was as much as anything, but it was the standard procedure and the rule even that the driver would get out. But the pit stops would normally last a minute and a half to 2 minutes sometimes, and the driver would go behind the wall. I've seen footage of Rex Mays. He gets out, he goes and sits on the wall, changes goggles, takes a drink, and everything is rather leisurely while they're doing the refueling and the tire changes if necessary. In 1946, George Robson made two stops, and he didn't get out of the car. And Leon Duray, who was the team manager for Jimmy Jackson finishing second, protested because it was a rule that you had to get out. They decided to let the rule stand, but they did give George Robson and his team a hefty fine. I don't remember what it was, but it was a cash fine, and everything else stood. And then the following year, they dropped the rule. But the interesting thing is that there's some drivers that still did that. The veteran drivers, certainly Maury Rose, got out. Every time he made a pit stop, he'd be out of the car, even up through the time that, for his last start in 51. And I think some of the other veterans did it. And then Johnny Parsons, who did not arrive at the Speedway until 49, in 50 at least, there's at least one pit stop where he gets out and walks around and throws the goggles over the wall and gets a fresh pair and wipes his face with a rag before getting back in the car. So that was fairly standard. And as far as changes in pit rules, boy, that's... in the early days, it was pretty much the driver and the mechanic did the majority of the work. I don't think it was ever a requirement here that they do, but in Grand Prix racing, it was. Just the driver and the rider mechanic had to do all the work. And the crew could hand them a wrench if it was needed, but the crew were not allowed to actually do the wrenching. Well, I'm sure that eventually went away, but that was never the rule here. So the other rules would be, I suppose, in terms of apparel, because up until on into, golly, I don't remember when the crew first started to wear uniforms, but... you know, it was T-shirts or golf shirts and jeans or team pants, but always short-sleeve shirts until not that long ago. And then the crew started to wear fireproof uniforms, and I don't recall what year that was. And then into the 90s, then helmets were required for anybody that was over the wall. So those would be the main changes. Anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call, and let's go to Larry. You're up next. Good evening, and thank you for calling.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Fine, sir. Thanks.
I hope you have a great race day on Sunday. It's always wonderful to hear you every year.
Well, thank you.
Yep. A couple things. Larry Rice passed today. So
I heard that.
I'd like to hear his USAC career. And
okay.
Also, could you tell me the last year J.C. Agajanian was at the track and the last years of that team before Kerry started, you know, working with Greg Beck, you know, as a sponsor and things. I kind of want to hear the last few years of the original Agajanian team at Indy.
I don't know which part to take first, but I'll do the Agajanian part. The last time that Aggie, it was Agajanian fast racers after he started taking on partners. Agajanian King races with Grant King in 76, I think, was about it. In 77, Gary Bettenhausen drove an Evel Knievel-sponsored car, and I think that Agajanian may have had an involvement with that because he actually was an early benefactor of Evel Knievel. When Evel Knievel didn't have very much money to spend, Agajanian had him regularly performing at Ascot Park in Gardena. But I think that was probably about it. He was Aggie, after he was no longer a sole owner, he was involved with Leader Cards for a little bit, and then Grant King. The last time he was at the track would have been 83, because he passed away before the 84 race, and I think he was coming right until the end. And then as far as Kerry's involvement was concerned, I don't know exactly when that would have happened, but he did driver representation, and also he was involved with Mike Kerb. So I would think that in 85, when Sneva and Ed Pym drove for Gurney, I think Mike Kerb was involved in that. So I would imagine Kerry was around then, and certainly when John Andretti came here in 88, they were very close. So that's sort of kind of a roundabout answer. I would like to talk about Larry Rice, and in fact, I hope that wasn't a shock the way that you learned that, if you did not know, but it was not a surprise, but nevertheless very sad to learn today that Larry Rice did pass away, I believe this morning, or sometime around noon or just prior to, and I do have quite a few thoughts on him, and so I'll do a piece when we return. And the number to call, by the way, to get on the end of the line here is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We'll talk about the career of Larry Rice when we return. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and as the caller mentioned, it was with great sadness that we announced that Larry Rice did pass away today. And to talk about his career a little bit and then him as a person, we'll take a few minutes to do that here. Typically, we start out with the Indianapolis 500 record. So in 1974, he first appeared here with a car called the Precision Engine Special, which was actually a real shoestring budget with a Chevy engine. And he practiced, but he wasn't able to start a rookie test. And in fact, they went out several times, couldn't get the speed. They made changes, and then apparently they. I'm trying to remember what happened now, because he told this story, so I should have rehearsed this one. But I remember that he went out for the umpteenth time to see if they could get the speed up to start the test. And he finally came down the straightaway, or he completed a lap, he came down the straightaway, and he saw a crew member holding out the speed, which I think was probably at that time 140 or 145, that was the first phase. So he saw the board with the speed that they'd finally achieved after several days of trying, but were now fast enough to start the rookie test, And just a few feet behind him was the an official holding the black flag because they were dropping oil. So that was the end of that. Anyway, that was 74. And the next shot he had was 1978 when he made an arrangement with several friends of his, the principal one probably being Pat Santello, a longtime sprint car owner and champ dirt car owner, and they put together an operation. And as a matter of fact, it was Bryant Heating and Cooling was the sponsor, but it was actually the Headback Corporation, and it was co-sponsored by WIBC. And he qualified on the last day. It was really emotional because of the fact that he was local, and I probably should have started out by saying that Larry Rice was from Linden, Indiana, which is very close to Crawfordsville, and he basically was born into racing. His father, I think, was the postmaster of Linden, I believe it was, but somewhere over in that area, and Larry had just lived his whole life. Anyway, we'll go back onto that, but the car was the Bryant Heating and Cooling WIBC Special. He qualified late on the final day, and it was one of those neat teams that you'd love to see make it at, you know, between 5:30 and quarter to six on the final day. And he did say that his eyes misted it up as he was going down the backstretch after taking the checkered flag because he'd been coming to the track since he was a boy. Anyway, on race day, he almost made it to the finish, not quite. He blew an engine, came down the inside of the right next to the pit wall, and I think that Al Unser was probably taking the white flag. I know it was just within a couple of minutes of the race being over, and so he had to pull off into the first turn. He was running 10th when it happened, and he ended up 11th because Johnny Parsons pipped him, and then by that time everybody, the race was had run the extra 5 minutes that they used to give them, and everybody else was flagged in. So he did end up 11th. And what was the chances of him winning Rookie of the Year? Well, pretty slim, because Rick Mears was in for Penske and on the outside of the front row. Well, Rick Mears didn't finish, and it ended up that the balloting ended up in a tie. And I'll tell you a little inside story here. There used to be about, I think it was like 35 to 40 people would cast their ballots on Rookie of the Year. And there were two people that couldn't decide whether it should be Mears or Larry Rice. And so with the card that they give out with the first choice, second choice, third choice, two people put them co-winners on the first line, and then nobody on the second line, and then a third choice on the third line. So two people did that. And we went down for they would have the victory banquet, I think in those days was still at the Egyptian Room at the Moran. No, it might have gone to the it was at the convention center by there. But at another room in the convention center, they had the reception to announce Rookie of the Year. And it was normally like an hour or so before you'd go into the main dinner. And anyway, the two fellows who had voted for co-rookies were both in the room, and they went over to them and said, look, this is highly irregular, but we want to see if we can break the tie, so we're going to ask you fellows if we're going to give you another ballot. I guess I could tell this now. It's been 30 years. And they said, we'll give you another ballot, and would you please distinguish between your first choice, second choice? So they sent them to opposite ends of the room. You guessed it. One did first, second one way. The other did first, second the other way. And they came back and said, all right, you win co-rookies of the year. So anyway, the trivia is that Larry Rice was co-rookie of the year in 1978. Who was the other guy? Well, Rick Mears, as a matter of fact. Anyway, Rick Mears has just been so gracious about that over the years, and I think they just ran into each other not very long ago. And, you know, Rick Mears is as we all know, is just a prince of a man, and he's always been really sporting about the whole thing. Anyway, Rice did come back the next year and drove for Pat Santello again. This time he spun in turn two well into the race and ended up in the concrete, but not that hard, but enough to do damage over by the VIP suites, and he got 19th, and that was it. He was on the track in a couple of other years, just running very few laps, but it was basically those 2 years with an 11th and a 19th. His other career was pretty amazing. He started running USAC midgets in 1968, and he was third in 72 in points, first in 73, so he was the national midget champion, and then third in 74. He won the Silver Crown Championship in 77 and 81, and he was runner-up in sprints, and I think that was 83, so he never was able to win the sprint championship, but he did get second. The other thing, too, was that he did not have a lot of wins. I think he had 3 Silver Crown wins, but the Hoosier 100 was one. He had 5 Silver Crown wins and 3 sprints, and I forget how many midgets now, but it was many more. I think it was like 11 or 12. But when you got to seconds and thirds, then it really built up. And we just did these stats a couple of days ago when we knew that his time was short. And if you add up in Silver Crown, sprints, and midgets, his total number of starts was over 650 features. And if you add the first, seconds, and thirds, it's exactly 100. But he very rarely got in an accident. He was upside down at Ascot, and I think he got upside down in the Hoosier 100. But I think you don't need all of one hand to count the number of times that Larry Rice was upside down, or really in any kind of a skirmish. He'd bring him home. He was very, very, very gentle and very careful with equipment. He also went to Australia and New Zealand several times. They loved him down under because he did that for several winters. And he went to Ball State, by the way. He went to Ball State at the same time as David Latimer. But we're talking about Larry Rice, if you've just joined us, who sadly passed away today. He went to Ball State at the same time as Dave Letterman. He got a degree in marketing. And when he got out of school, he became a teacher. He taught 5th and 6th grade in a Crawfordsville school. And then he gave that up when he wanted to go racing full-time. And after he'd been racing for full-time, he went to work for K&K Insurance, Racetrack Insurance. And I really don't want to wrap it up here, so we're going to take a break here in a few moments, but I just have a few more thoughts on Larry Rice as a person. But he was a representative for K&K Insurance at Racetracks for many years, and then, of course, he got into broadcasting, and there's kind of a little bit within the broadcasting family here on how that got started, and we'll get to that when we come back. But anyway, we're talking about Larry Rice. We've got plenty of callers hanging on, and appreciate it. Hope you don't mind hanging on a little bit more. I guess you guys are all used to doing that on this program because we do tend to give long answers. But anyway, the number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. More thoughts on Larry Rice when we come back, and then we'll move on to the other callers. You were listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and to conclude thoughts on Larry Rice, accomplishments on the racetrack. I mean, he was a longtime USAC fan, racing fan. I mean, from childhood. In fact, when he first started going to races, it was before there was a USAC. His claim to one of his claims he was very proud of was in 1953, the first Hoosier 100 was held at the fairgrounds. And he went with his family. He would have been 7, I think, at the time. Anyway, the amazing thing is that he continued going as a boy and as a young adult, ended up driving in it, and then later was a broadcaster. So in one form or another, Larry Rice went to every Hoosier 100. He never missed one. There was a couple of years where they didn't have it. But we'll be thinking about him on Friday night when they run the Hoosier 100, and Larry will be there in spirit only. But he never missed a Hoosier 100. As far as the broadcasting career is concerned, the debut actually came, and I don't know that we would have a date, But through the sponsorship with Bryant Heating and Cooling on the car that with which he won co-rookie of the year in 78, the first day on WIBC used to have a regular host and a news person, and then rotating guests who would do community affairs and also sports. And it would be normally somebody that was not from that field. They would have, you know, guys that were pacers and so on and so forth. And Larry Rice started to do sports, and he did quite a few of those. And then it wasn't long before he started to do commentary or color, and he and Gary Lee hooked up to be the Gary and Larry show, and they did the Thunder series on ESPN, and I think they teamed for 19 years, and they made a number of other appearances as well. They did racetrack announcing and appearances at banquets and so on and so forth. And anyway, just in closing, a little personal note, was I always admired him for his demeanor. And there were two or three people who I've known for a long, long time, and I tend to, and maybe, you know, not everybody knows this, but my close friends know that I do tend to burn up from time to time. Scott Johnson is nodding. And I remember being influenced, I think, that Larry Rice would come in the USAC office and there would have been something would have taken place at a racetrack, of a controversial nature, and he just seemed to be able to laugh everything off. I only ever saw him upset once, but for the most part, he just seemed to just have a very easygoing attitude to life, and I thought of him a lot over the years, and I told him that. I don't know that I particularly learned the lesson, but I've thought of him so many times thinking, you know, Rice wouldn't be upset by this. And even when he realized that he was sick, he didn't let on. He was very private. He didn't really want to talk about it. He just brush it off. And the last time that I talked to him was probably 2 weeks ago. And he was just very bright and breezy and talking about a meeting, or, you know, a regular lunch munch that Charlie Brown's with Vukovic and Bettenhausen and Jerry Sneaver and Chassis and a bunch of others. And, he was just laughing about that. And they're all sort of getting on each other about what stuff that happened years ago or their personalities. And he just sits there and laughs at all of it. But anyway, the final thought is, and this is just really amazing, with over 650 starts in features in USAC, and then hundreds more heats, and running down under in Australia and New Zealand, to have run that many times, and the opportunity for confrontations with other drivers, and then to have done commentary for, 25, 30 years or whatever it is, at least 25, and to occasionally be in the position of having to express an opinion, which may not be, to everyone's satisfaction. He was very, very skillful with that. And then to have been involved in racetrack insurance, and sometimes having to deliver messages to racetrack owners or promoters that may not necessarily be good news. And yet, I never heard anybody say a bad thing about him. And we've been talking about this for several weeks, and I hope you forgive me if I just do a little extra number on this, but we all agree that Larry Rice never had an enemy in the world, and he was just a truly great guy. And to see how he handled his final months with such dignity, and we really lament his passing, but we do have the memories. Anyway, Larry Rice did pass away today. Let's go back to the phones. And, Peter, thank you for hanging on.
Donald, wonderful to speak with you, an honor. And always been impressed by the F1 drivers, Formula 1 drivers that have made it to the Motor Speedway. In my era, Pedro Rodriguez and Mastin Gregory and Jochen Rindt, and then a little later, Clay Regazzoni. Wondered if it was true that Wally Weir, I believe, was a car owner. I may mispronounce his name, but that he was going to have Lorenzo Bandini drive at the Motor Speedway.
Yep.
And also wondered if Parnelli Jones was ever offered in a Formula One ride with Colin Chapman, either for one or two races or for a season in Team Lotus with Colin Chapman. And I wondered in closing if you ever met, if you ever had a chance to meet Mike Spence.
No, I never met Mike Spence. I'll probably have to make a two-parter at this, but the quick answers are that, Wally Weir is the correct pronunciation, and Lorenzo Bandini was going to drive for him, and I can tell you the story because I knew Wally Weir quite well, and I knew all of that was happening. And was Parnelli offered a Formula One ride with Lotus? Yes. Chapman wanted him to go running Grand Prix, but Parnelli decided that he wanted to stay home. But if you want to hang on for a couple of minutes here, I will elaborate. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the talk of Gasoline Alley, and the caller was asking about if Parnelli Jones had ever been offered a Formula One ride, and yes, he was. I think it was for the 65 season. I mean, they were very impressed. You know, Jim Clark in a Lotus was second to Colin Chapman had had a look at Parnelli Jones in 62 because he was at the race as Dan Gurney's guest, and Parnelli, even according to Roger Ward, morally won that one and ended up seventh because the brakes failed, and he ran about the last 200 miles without brakes, and then he won the race in 63 over Jim Clark, and as much of a controversy was blew up about that in the eyes of the public between the two drivers. Clark and Jones had great respect for each other, and in 64, because Clark ran in addition to Indianapolis in 63, he ran at Milwaukee and won the 200 miler, and then in Trenton he broke down. In 64, he ran Indianapolis only because there were conflicts with the other races that they wanted to run. And so at the Milwaukee 200 and Trenton and Phoenix, the substitute for Clark was Parnelli Jones. And he won Milwaukee and he won Trenton and then I think broke down at Phoenix. But anyway, either for the later 64 or for 65, because they realized Parnelli was a good road racer as well, because he won sports car races in addition to just what he was showing on the big ovals. But Chapman did talk to him about going over there, but Parnelli just decided he wanted to stay here and be close to home. I did not meet Mike Spence. And then the other thing about Wally Weir from Webster Groves, Missouri, who I met in 64, he was one of several car owners, and again, here I go inserting myself a little bit. He used to talk to me about who he was thinking of hiring for his next driver. And this one threw me for a loop when he called up in after Watkins Glen in 66. He said, guess who's going to drive for me next year? Lorenzo Bandini. And I about fell down. I said, Lorenzo Bandini, how did you get him? Well, Wally Weir had a Firestone contract, and Bandini was driving for Ferrari, and they were on Firestones at that time. And so he went up to Watkins Glen and found Bandini and said, and I don't think Bandini spoke very good English. I'm not too sure about that. But anyway, Wally said, I want you to drive for me at Indianapolis. And then when the subject of money came up, I think it was mostly done in mime. And I think he said, how much would you want to drive for me? And so according to Wally at the time, Bandini held up four fingers and a thumb, meaning $5,000. And Wally nodded no and then held up both hands. In other words, I'll pay you $10,000, and which was a good deal of money at that time. So Bandini's eyes really opened up. He came to the track. He came for a tire test, and I don't recall if this was early 67. It was around the time of the Sebring 12 Hours, and I know that Jackie Stewart was here, and I think maybe Graham Hill, to run tire tests, and Bandini was here and got a look at the track, but you know, he was never on the track, and that continued. He never was on the track, but he was going to come here in 67. He was the entered driver, and Monaco was a little earlier in May than it was in some other years, and he had this terrible accident involving fire, and the safety was not what it was at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and so he perished. And when the drivers showed up here, Dennis Holm and Rindt and everybody coming over from the Grand Prix with their heads hung low because, you know, Bandini, they just lost Bandini, but, you know, you keep on going. I don't know if you had any more follow-up questions about other drivers that may have come here, and then we ought to move on with the other callers. Okay, let's go to Mike then. You're up next. Thanks for calling. Hello, Mike. Or Jerry. Or Jared. Or somebody. All right, maybe we better take a break. Should we just take an early break? All right, let's do that. We'll take an early break. We'll get things figured out here and then take calls when we get back. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. You will listen to the Talk of Gasoline Alley from 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, and let's go straight to the phones. And Mike, you're up next. Thanks for hanging on.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Is this
Mike? Mike Vernon Hills. How are you doing?
Oh, yes, Mike.
I haven't disappeared. I just had was sick last week. So.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I'm better now. I have two questions. One was jogged by the previous caller, and that is, did A.J. Foyt ever have offers to do Formula One? And my original question was around the 500 song that you used to hear on the Sid Collins radio broadcast. I wonder if you could talk about that and the origin of that and how it got on the air and so forth.
Okay. Foyt was not only offered a Formula One ride in 19. If you get the 1964 Watkins Glen Grand Prix program, there is a Lotus, and I think it's listed, or somewhere there's an entry list that is for either Parnelli Jones or A.J. Foyt, and neither one of them ran, but they were both entered as possibles on the same car. Foyt never had any interest in running Formula One, but he could have, and it would have been interesting to see what he would have done up there. The song, The 500, was written by a pharmacist in Carmel named Joe Jordan. He's deceased now, but he has family members that are around. And he went to Sid Collins, and I don't know the exact order of this happening, but I think he probably talked to Sid about the fact that he'd written this song. And you don't know what to think when somebody says, I've written a song, you know, or I've written some poetry, or I want to write a book, I've got an idea for a novel. You never quite know where the thing is going. But it came to pass that the song was recorded, and it was done by the Indiana University Glee Club, is it, I think? I got to be careful because there's that other school that's in the opposite direction. No, it's the singing. Is it the Singing Hoosiers, I think, is what it's listed as. And there is a... they got an orchestration that was done by a fellow named Al Cobain, who had a dance band, and was quite well known throughout the state. And it was recorded, I'm assuming, in 1961, because it was issued. It was on a 45, and it's got the 500 song on one side, and then I think Back Home Again in Indiana is on the other side. It's the Singing Hoosiers on a 45, and it was issued in like an EP sleeve, or I believe gatefold is the term, and so heavy cardboard rather than a paper sleeve, and it opens like a book, and the front page was the a photograph of the parade lap or pace lap of the 61 500 with the Ford Thunderbird in the foreground, and I don't recall recall at what point it became part of the broadcast. I think it already was when I showed up, so they must have adopted it right away. I don't think it was the other way around to be... well, it might have been the same year. I don't know. But when I showed up, it was already there. And it's very nostalgic to hear that. You hear it from time to time. The what is known as the bumps on the broadcast to this day is a version of it. But I hear people asking me all the time. They'd like to hear the vocal version. But anyway, Mike, we thank you very much indeed for the call. And let's see if we can get to Jeff and Don before we're done on this segment. So, Jeff, thanks for hanging on.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Fine, sir.
I just, hopefully I didn't miss none of your show. I just want to hear you maybe speak a little bit about my favorite open wheel guy, Rich Vogler.
Okay, yeah. I think, I don't think, have we been asked about Vogler this year? I think maybe one time. He did drive in the 500, 85, 86, 87, 88, and 89, and was there in other years. He actually passed the test in 80. And the best finish that he had was 8th in 89. And I'm sort of hurrying through the 500 record because the real forte was short tracks. His father was Don Vogler, who was a midget driver. I think Don Vogler may have run sprints just a handful of times, but basically he was midgets. And so Rich was raised going to the racetracks from the time he was a little kid. And he started racing, you know, seriously when he was a teenager. And he won the Silver Crown Championship and the Midget Championship and the Speedrome Regional Midget Series. And I can't tell you the numbers now, but he won with great regularity. So he was one of the great short track drivers ever, and he was... had huge arms and huge hands, Popeye arms and huge hands, and because he wasn't a big person, and in fact Sheldon Kinzer and he were rather similar in that respect, in that they had these big ham hands with fingers that were like sausages, and it didn't matter where he started, he'd always find a way to the front, so inverted stats didn't bother him at all. And I remember, like down at the Hoosier Dome, running the Thunder in the Dome, where the track was completely flat, and they would put down a Coke syrup in order to try and make the track sticky, and so everybody would pretty much be not really follow the leader, but they'd stay to the inside pretty much, and the outside groove normally wouldn't work, but by golly, Vogler would stay out there and make it work. And I've seen him at the Speedrome trying to do outside passes on a mail train on the inside, and he just stays out there, and would gradually move forward. So he could be very patient and very tenacious. The nickname was Mad Dog, and I don't know whether that was really fair or not, but he was a great performer. And in 1990 was the last year. The last year that he tried to qualify for the 500 and was not successful, was also the last year of his life, because he lost his life in a sprint car race at Salem, which, appropriately enough, he won. He crashed coming around for the checker, and they stopped the race, and typically with USAC, the rule was that they would revert to the previous lap, and it was decided to just give him the victory. But there is a little trivia that in 1990, and he would run 60, 70, 80 times a year. And actually, I went on a trip with him down to Rushville. We used to go down to Rushville and gave talks at the Knights of Columbus for years and years. In 1990, I rode down with Vogler, and he told me at that time, he said, I'm not going to be racing this much this year. I've decided I'm going to spend some more time with my family. Anyway, he did miss the show in 1990, but he was going to run a sprint car at Raceway Park that night. And just real quick was that in 87, he dropped out of the 500 at about halfway, went out to Eagle Creek or the Speedway Airport, I think, and flew his plane to Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, so he could run a midget that night. Anyway, he went to, he missed the show at the Speedway, went out to the fair, went out to IRP to run the sprint car, and he retained another driver to hot lap it for him until he could get there. And it was a teenager named Jeff Gordon, and when he got out there, Gordon had just hit the wall, so he was out there as well. Anyway, Don, hang on. You'll be first up when we come back on the other side. We're going to do another hour here as we hook up with Network Indiana, so there will be more of the talk of Gasoline Alley when we return. So we'll just take a few minutes break here, take a breather, and we'll be back and do another hour of the talk of Gasoline Alley. So stay with us.
This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We will be here until 8 o'clock answering your questions of a nostalgic nature. And the number to call will be 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We are coming to you live from the garage area at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And we'd like to thank the Dryan Reinbold Racing Team for allowing us to use their garage as a home away from home. It's a beautiful evening, which is typical because there's no track activity today. But we did have Community Day, which was very well attended. And everybody's kind of gone, and we're just sitting out enjoying a very beautiful, peaceful spring evening. Anyway, we will be here until 8 o'clock answering your questions. We've got Don on the phone, so you're first up. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, with tomorrow being Carburation Day, who was the last driver, last car, and the last year that they actually ran carburetors?
Okay, that's actually a tie. 1963 is the year, and the two Lotuses that were Ford powered, they used a stock block 4.2 liter engine, which was based on the engine that Ford was using in all of its big passenger cars. And Jim Clark and Dan Gurney were the drivers. And when they went out to run the final practice session or carburation runs, they were the last people to actually use carburetors. So that would be the answer to that one. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And next up is Bob. Good evening. Thanks for calling.
Good evening, Mr. Davidson. How are you?
I'm fine, sir.
For years I've heard discussions about the end of gasoline at the Speedway.
Yes.
And I heard you speaking about that earlier, and we're almost where we need to be. I do believe that the turbine used JP1 jet fuel, but the 68 turbines went from 4 to 2 stage turbine cars, and they substituted white gasoline, that is unleaded gas, for kerosene. So I believe that they may have been the last cars to actually run 100% gasoline mixture in 1968.
Well, I honestly, that could be. There were all kinds of claims as to what the fuel was in those cars, and I never knew really quite what to believe. But we do know that gasoline was not ruled out completely, or banned, if some people want to say it, until much later. And I haven't gone back through the rule books to see when that was. As I did say on an earlier program, I had been under the impression until probably 4 or 5 years ago that gasoline was not permitted after 1964, and it turns out that that's not true, because some people did use mixes. And what you just said about the turbines, I'm sure is true. In fact, I think it might have been avgas, but anyway, I can't take issue with anything that you said, and so very possibly, yeah, 1968 turbines might have been the last one. Although they didn't make the race, Jack Adams ran one in 69 and 70, which didn't make the race, and I don't know what their fuel was. But anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call, and let's go to Jim. Good evening.
Yeah, hi, Donald. How are you?
Fine, sir.
Hey, I just noticed coming to this memorabilia show this Friday at the Coliseum, a blast from the past here, Ralph LaGore.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, I remember as a kid going out there, I think it was probably the mid to late 60s, maybe early 70s, and he was kind of a crowd favorite, always trying to get in on the last day, and I don't think he ever made the race.
He never did, nope.
And I was just wondering, and I'll hang up and listen here, could you just give, if you haven't talked about him already this year, just a recap of his driving history and history at the five?
Okay, well, Ralph Liguori, I'll do the Speedway first. 1959 with the Eldorado Italia Special with a Maserati engine, qualified but was bumped. And as he told somebody just recently, it had been driven at Monza by an Englishman. And I don't know if he couldn't remember the name or was just assuming that the listener might not have known. The listener wasn't me. Anyway, that is correct information. The Englishman was Stirling Moss, who had driven that car that was built for the Monza 500 in 1958. Anyway, Ralph qualified and got bumped with that car. In 60, he was entered in the Federal Engineering Detroit Special, but he was unable to drive because he had an accident at Trenton in the last race before Indianapolis and got a broken arm, so he had to sit that one out. In 61, Andy Granatelli and his brothers had just bought the Novi team from Lou Welsh. They bought one car to the track, and Ralph was one of several drivers that got in it, but unfortunately he ended the career of the Novi that year. He had a major blown engine, and parts came out all over the place, and so that was the end of that run. In 62... he was in a couple of different cars, but never went to the qualifying line. In 63, this was the heartbreaker. This was the real eye-blink situation. Now, he drove a car for Ollie Prather called the Schultz Fueling Equipment Special, which had Jimmy McAreath had driven to sixth the year before and won Rookie of the Year. Ralph qualified, and he got bumped. And then Len Sutton also qualified and got bumped, and the two of them had identical speeds. So although I think they broke it down to an extra decimal place, which made Len Sutton the first alternate and Ralph the second alternate, and that is the closest that he got. In 64, he drove for Ollie Prather in practice, and also he was in the Jim Robbins Autocrat Seatbelt Special, and did not make qualifying runs with those. In 65, it looked like a really good shot because he had the Daimler Special that Johnny White had driven to fourth the year before, and Ralph didn't get that one in either. In fact, on the eve of the first qualifying day, he got upside down in turn two. 66 and 67, he drove for Walt Flynn in a rear-engine car that had been driven by Don Branson in 65. And he made attempts but didn't make it in, and or didn't complete. And then in 68 he was driving for the Walthers, the Dayton Steel Foundry Special, and had an engine problem while he was taking a refresher test, so he never made it into the race. But anyway, quickly on Ralph's career, he actually was an early NASCAR driver. And 51, 52, 53, 54, he was a NASCAR regular when NASCAR was very different. Virtually all of the races were dirt tracks, and they would typically run like 100 lap or on a quarter mile, and they'd run 50, 60, 70 times a year. And I think it's 1953 when he finished in the top 10. He may have finished in the top 10 twice. If he didn't make the top 10 in 54, I think might have been like 11th. But he was a NASCAR regular, and then also for a season and a half, NASCAR ran an open wheel series called the Speedway Division, and in the curtailed one in 1953, he was second in points in that. He ran USAC sprint cars. He ran a lot of championship races. By far the best finish that he had was in the 1970 Hoosier 100, when late in the race, Al Unser was leading, when it was a national championship race. Al Unser's leading, A.J. Foyt second, Ralph Liguori is third. Can he hang on? Yes. In fact, Foyt had a right rear going down, and Liguori was able to get around him, and he finished second to Al Unser in the 1970 Hoosier 100. That's the last year it was a championship race. Anyway, Ralph continued racing for quite a number of years after that and was still running the Speedrome in the 80s, now retired, and he has a grandson that's running with USAC. Anyway, that's Ralph Liguori. Plenty more callers hanging on. We need to take a break. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and my brain's still not working for me terribly well on Ralph Liguori. He was ninth in points. It might have been 1954. And if he missed 10th in 53, it wasn't by much. But anyway, one thing I would be remiss if I don't bring up, and if he was listening, he would bring up, was don't forget that he would say, don't forget I won Langhorne in 57. And they had twin 50-lap sprint races on the Langhorne Mile when it was still dirt in 57. And he won the second 50-lap in record time, and that's a record that would never be broken because Langhorne was paved over in 1965. Anyway, go back to the phones, and Jerry from Delphi, you're up next.
Hello, Donald.
Hi, Jerry. Thanks for hanging on.
That's all right. I had you on speakerphone for a while.
Okay.
I'd like to know if you'd profile Gene Hartley for me.
Okay. Gene Hartley was from Roanoke, Indiana. Forte was midgets, although he had a very good career, very steady career at Indianapolis, and as you'll pick up along the way here, he was very good about, he would sit out there and he'd bring them home. In 1950 was his first start, a very young Gene Hartley. I think he was probably 23, 24 years old when he drove the Troy Oil Special, which was sponsored by a company down on the south side of Indianapolis, on Troy Avenue, and the race was stopped at 345 miles because of rain with Johnny Parsons the winner, and Gene Hartley was flagged off in 16th place. In 51, he was not entered because he was on a AAA suspension because he was not that great about towing the line at all times, and in 52, he was back to drive the Mel Ray Special and was out to finish 28th, so we're not getting off to a great start here, but hang on. In 1953, he was drove for Federal Engineering, drove the dirt car, and finished 28th, but he got back into the race as a relief driver for Tony Battenhausen in the Agajanian Special. Actually, Chuck Stevenson relieved first, and then Gene took over, and they ended up ninth, but they weren't running at the end. Gene actually crashed on his 196th lap, and Vukovic had already won the race, and as we have recounted several times in the last few days, when the winner crossed the line then, they would let the race go for a reasonable amount of time, and the cars were coming in third, fourth, fifth, and Gene Hartley was trying to make it to the checker, and he crashed on the 196th lap, and he'd already crashed earlier with the Federal Engineering car on the year of the big, the terrible heat. And as his wife told me one time, she said, I heard, you know, over the public address that he'd crashed in turn two. And she said, I'm in a summer dress and white high heels. And she said, I made my way over to the infield hospital, and it was like cinder paths in those days. And she said, I arrived there and about ready to pass out. And he's in the hospital sitting up on a bed being checked out, and he's okay. She said, I went back to the grandstands to watch the race some more, and Vukovic wins the race, and Art Cross, who we knew very well, gets second. And then I'll hear over the public address that Gene Hartley crashed again, and she said, I'm not going to the hospital another time. Anyway, he wasn't injured in that one either, but he does go into a rather bizarre history books as he's one of the few drivers, not the only one, because Andy Linden did the same thing, to actually go to the hospital because of an accident twice in the same race. All right, 54, Gene Hartley drove the John Zink Special and was 23rd with Marshall Teague as a co-driver. 55, he drove for Carl Hall of Orleans, Indiana, Commercial Motor Freight Special, incomplete attempt. 56, Central Excavating Special for Pete Salemi and finished 11th. This was the car that Manny Aiello had lost his life in the year before, but different in those days. They'd hammer out the car, get a new driver. So that was back repaired in time for 56, and Gene Hartley finished 11th. In 57 with the Massaglia Hotel Special, which a family member, I always called it Massaglia. A family member tells me Massaglia Hotel Special, and he finished 10th. 58, Hoyt Machine Special, locally owned, qualified, bumped, first alternate starter. 59, Drury Special, owned by Red Marley and Ashley Wright from South Bend. And Drury's was the beer up there. I don't know if that one's still going on or not. And 11th again, went the full 200 laps. And then in 60 was the Sumar Special and was flagged off in 14th. 61, John Chalik Special, 11th again. And then 62 was his last start, the Drury Special. Didn't feel happy in it, and I think after 24 laps came in, gave it to Bill Cheeseburg, who did three more, and then they were out. And then in 63, driving the Drury Special, which Watson Roadston now, by the way, the 11th place Drury Special in 59 was a Kuzma. Anyway, in 63, was in practice, and then just came in and just said, I don't think I want to do this anymore, and he basically retired at that point. Midgets, outstanding career in USAC, and there's something quite amazing about this. He was third in points in 57, third in 58, won the championship in 59, and then third in 60 and 61. So that's the top three, 5 years in a row. Now, in order to stay up high in midgets, you had to run a lot. And I had not been at USAC very long, a couple of years perhaps, and I was doing some research and going back, looking through the Turkey Night, the Thanksgiving Grand Prix at Gardena and then later at Ascot Park. And I happened to notice that Gene Hartley didn't show up in any of the results. And almost every driver would go from here out there, and even if they didn't run any other West Coast. So he would come into the USAC office quite often, probably a couple of times a week, long since retired now, to see Bob Stroud, who was the midget supervisor. And I asked him about that, and I said, I can't see where you've ever run Turkey Night. He said, no, I never ran out west. I said, what? You didn't go to Phoenix or any of the other tracks? He said, no. I said, but what about the points? He said, I never chase points. He said, I race for money. And he said, I would look at the purse and look at the travel expenses, and if I didn't figure I had a chance to come back with at least a little bit more than I left with, I saw no point in going. And he said, in fact, I just picked and chose my tracks. He said, I didn't like running Langhorn. And that was by far his best championship finish, and I'm almost done here. In 1956, he drove at Langhorn in the championship race, and he finished second behind George Amick. And I said, you didn't like Langhorn, but you finished second. He said, yeah, but I didn't like it, so I never went back. And that was just typical Gene Hartley. He and Leroy Warriner, also another great midget champion, 1953, the two of them teamed up, and people in the Indianapolis area will remember that for quite a few years, it was Leroy Warriner and Gene Hartley that ran the affair out at the Speedrome. Anyway, Gene Hartley is deceased now. He had his birthday was the same day as Jimmy Bryan. They were both January the 28th, and I remember that one very well because that's my birthday as well. Anyway, thanks very much indeed, Jerry, for asking about Gene Hartley. He was an interesting guy with a cynical outlook on life, but very entertaining nevertheless. All right, Greg, Dave, Ryan, John, hang on. We will be back and get to all of you when we return. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We got just under a half hour left on tonight's version of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. We will be back tomorrow and Friday from 7 until 8 on Network Indiana. And that'll be it for the season. Oh, no. Anyway, we got half an hour, so let's use it up. And Greg, you're up next.
Hi, Donald. This is Greg from Chicago.
Yes, sir. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about the finish of the race. You mentioned it a little
today's
bit.
Today's dairy.
There was a point in time where drivers could drive.
Greg, you'll have to repeat the question again because we lost you momentarily, and it probably was key information. So restate the question, please.
Okay. At a point in time, there was the drivers were allowed to continue a significant time after the finish of the race.
Yes.
I was wondering when that was in effect and if there was any specific rules or if it was just a guideline.
Okay. From the beginning, they figured, as with AAA, with all the championship races, they figured that as many cars as was reasonable should go the distance. If it was a 100-mile race, in order to get prize money, you should go 100 miles. So Springfield just name whatever the track was at that time, people would be going home, and the cars are still, running to finish 7th and 8th. The board track races would go on at great length, and Indianapolis always did that. For the first few years, prize money was only to the first 12 finishers, and then for a while it was the first 10 finishers. And they would let the cars go, until they had at least 10. And the extreme example is 1912, when the 10th place car finally came home 2.5 hours after the winner had crossed the line. It took 8 hours and 53 minutes. Well, they sort of amended that a little bit, but they still let it go for a reasonable amount of time. And I think if you look at the elapsed times, and they're in the program, I mean, they show you at least the top 10, and maybe beyond that, I don't know. But it was not unusual for, 45, 50 minutes or an hour. And as the speeds went up and the races didn't take as long, things would get tighter. But into the 50s, I think probably a half an hour was not unusual, but there was no set time. I think it's whatever they just felt was reasonable, or if the starter wanted to go home early, they'd flag him in. But in 1963 was the last year that they pretty much had the same arrangement, and they went for 17 minutes. And in order to get Eb Rose home in 14th place, and I've had people actually say, well, look, in 63, there was 14 cars in the lead lap, or the extreme was 1916. It's still the record where 16 cars went 200 laps. But the 16th place guy wasn't in the lead lap. He completed 200 laps, but when Roger Ward won the race, Jim McWithey probably had 12, 13 laps to go. Well, in 63, again, 17 minutes, and Eb Rose finished 14th. The following year, MCA did the closed-circuit television for the first time, and what they wanted to do was to have the winner interviewed on the track. So they wanted everybody to be flagged off as soon as the winner crossed the line. Well, the champion 100-mile-an-hour club was still going at that time, and rather than get into a long explanation of that, they did make a compromise where they would run for 5 minutes, and that's what they did from 64 through to 74. However, in 1974, they had a situation when Johnny Rutherford won the race, and he took a couple of extra laps, and then he was coming in on the call-off lap. A large number of people on the infield jumped over the fence and went out to, wave at trackside. I mean, they didn't run on the track, but they went out to trackside to wave him, as the winner. Well, there's other cars going by at speed, and so the officials threw the red after 3.5 minutes, and then they decided that for the following year, they would then do as they are doing now, that they would checker everybody. And so if you came down and the winner's behind you, you got the white flag, and he got the checker right behind you, then you would be able to go around and take the checker, but nobody would be going around another time after that. And anyway, so that was going to be implemented in 1975, but they didn't get to use it because the race was stopped because of rain, and then in 76 it was stopped at just past halfway because of rain. But 77 was the first year that they had an opportunity to use that ruling, and it's been that way ever since. They were going to do it in 75, but they didn't because of the rain. Okay, Greg? All right, we thank you very much, and let's move on to Dave. You're up next.
Donald?
Yes, sir. Dave from Marion.
Hi there, Donald.
Hi.
well, it's Wednesday, and tomorrow's Terre Haute, and then the champ cars at the fairgrounds, and we're winding down here, my friend.
Yeah, the Hoosier 100 ad at the fairgrounds on Friday night. Uh-huh.
First, some editorial comment, Larry Rice. That very nice remarks. Anybody who was at the old-timers recognition dinner last Friday, if they didn't happen to notice, he was president of the old-timers, I guess, currently.
That's correct.
And so at the beginning of the program, there's what you might call his goodbye.
Yeah.
Too bad he couldn't have been there one more time. One of my favorite 500 memories from the races I've seen, would you talk some about the wonderful drive from near the rear of the field in 62 of both Eddie Sachs and Troy Ruttman?
Yes, I would love to. I'll tell you what, let's just take the break right here. I'm not going to look anything up. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I don't want to sort of start and then have to stop. So hang there, Dave. We will take a break, and we will be right back and do the epic ride of Eddie Sachs and Troy Ruttman in the 1962 Indianapolis 500. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. For the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and our very faithful listener and caller, Dave from Marion, Indiana, wants to talk about the epic rides from Eddie Sachs and Troy Ruttman in 62. Eddie Sachs had been on the pole in 60 and 61 and stood to be able to accomplish what nobody had done and still hasn't, and that is win the pole 3 years in a row. And he had a very difficult 1962. And just to go back to 61, they had that epic finish with Sachs taking the lead late because Foyt had to stop his refueling mechanism had malfunctioned on his third and what should have been his final pit stop, and so he went off with no fuel and had to come back in again to make an emergency stop, and that gave the lead to Eddie Sachs, and Sachs could have slowed down and probably protected the win, but he did not, and then ended up wearing through the cords on the right rear and elected to come in and make a stop. There are those that think that he could have slowed down and saved the win, and among those was Foyt, who benefited from the fact that Sachs stopped. In fact, Foyt even was quoted in one newspaper saying that Sachs was a dumb race driver. Well, to smooth that over a little bit, Sachs is having problems in practice in 62, and in those days, test hops were quite common among drivers where they would try each other's cars and give an opinion. And who gets in to try to drive Sachs's car? Foyt. And Foyt had left Dean Van Lines running in 58 and 59, and Clint Brawner wasn't very happy about that because they figured that they had a future coming 500 winner in Foyt, and then he took off to drive for Bignotti and Bowes, and Brawner wasn't very happy about it, but whatever the circumstances, I have no idea. But with that, with Brawner, and the quotes in the press, Foyt's helping Sachs sort the car out. Well, they didn't get qualified until the last weekend. He started 27th, and Troy Ruttman qualified 30th, which is the outside of the 10th row. And Ruttman came all the way up to second with the Jim Robbins special laydown late in the race. I think it was still Parnelli Jones leading, and or it might have been Foyt by then, because I know at 140 laps Ruttman was running second, but he was already running into problems and then had to drop out. But Sachs was able to get to third. And Ward won it. Len Sutton, his teammate, was second, and Sachs was third. And Bob Laycock, the late Bob Laycock, who was the historian at the Speedway, one of the things that he would do was to show how fast everybody was running on the track, he would take the elapsed time of all the pit stops and then subtract them to see who was the fastest on the track. And in 1958, that information showed that Jimmy Reese actually ran the 500 miles faster than anyone else if you took out the pit stops. And in 1962, Eddie Sachs actually ran the 500 miles faster than Ward and Sutton, but Ward and Sutton had superior pit stops. So I think, Dave, that's the story that you wanted, and so thank you very much for asking about that one, because I remember listening on the radio when I was in England, listening to the 62 broadcast, and just thrilled to learn that Troy Ruttman was running second, not so thrilled to learn that he dropped out. But, you know, Ruttman was always trying to duplicate the form of 1952, and he would lead the race. And that happened several times. I mean, he led it in 57, They led it in 60 and 61, and always something would happen. Anyway, let's try to get a few more in here, and let's go back to the phones. And Ryan, you're next. Good evening.
Hi, Donald.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. Ready to come up to Indy.
Good.
Hey, before I ask my question, can I pass on a quick comment on Rich Vogler?
Sure.
Yeah, watching on the Thunder program, he was a bit of a hero of mine, I guess, when I was a little kid. But the night after he died, he was going to run his first career NASCAR Winston Cup race in Talladega.
Pocono.
Yeah.
It was Pocono.
It was Pocono?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know more than me, but... anyway, I always kind of love the, you know, the little guy that clearly doesn't have the money or the talent, but still goes out there and they give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me to thinking about Tony Bettenhausen Jr. and when he raced and then when he owned a team.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, just kind of a, I mean, did he really ever reach any kind of success in his career as a driver?
Oh, yeah, I'd say so. I mean, he didn't have the success of his father in terms of finishes or Gary, but he did get 7th, and he got 10th. And before I go further with that, I was rather definite in Vogler at Pocono. I'm sure that that is correct, that he had qualified for the Pocono 500 and then had the accident at Salem on a Saturday night and was going to go back to Pocono. And they left the spot open for him. They didn't fill it or put another driver in. They just simply, I think they show him as last place in the box score, I believe. But Tony Bettenhausen was 7th as a rookie in 81. He was a very steady driver. He brought them home. He didn't like to qualify. I do know that. Of all the drivers that I've ever talked to who have talked about what an ordeal qualifications is, I don't think anybody put it stronger than Tony Bettenhausen. In fact, I'm not sure whether he finally got to the point where he had to wave off. But for the longest time, he had this. He would qualify the first time, and never wave off. And it was always a huge, huge relief when he'd got it, because you could just tell from the look in his face where he would widen his eyes. And he'd just been through something that he really didn't enjoy very much. But I'll talk a little bit about Tony Bettenhausen. This is the son, Tony Bettenhausen, when we return. But it is time to take another break. So hang with us, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We have a few minutes left on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. We will be back tomorrow night on Network Indiana at 7 o'clock, and then also on Friday for the final show of the season. But anyway, we've got a few minutes to go here. John, you've been hanging on very patiently. You're up. What would you like to hear about?
Hey, Donald, thanks for taking my call. Do I get in before they shot the gun off then?
Yes, the gun hasn't gone off.
Okay. I was interested to find out who would be the longest tenured or continuous car sponsorship that made the race at the track, and particularly if you had some time to talk about leader card after my initial question.
Well, as far as sponsors is concerned, first of all, I say the longest tenure as a participant is A.J. Foyt, who's either been a driver or an owner since 1958, so this is actually the 52nd year that Foyt has been a participant. Second at the moment is probably Ron Hemelgarn, who began sponsoring. He might have been on a car in 79, but I know in by 80, and he started out as a sponsor with Silhouette National Health Spars, and then by 85 is when he became an owner. He was very much involved with the Chris Neifel operation in 83 and 84, but then by 85, then he was the owner, and he's entered a car every year since. They did, there was a couple of times when they didn't run, and Agajanian had a long run from 48 till, and that's you don't quite know when to wind that up, because as we did on an earlier show, He became associated with other car owners and became partners with them. As far as sponsorship, a long one was Bryant Heating and Cooling, except that that wasn't the Bryant factory in the first many years. It was a local dealer, Phil Headback, and that goes from 58 up until 70. And then in 71, they didn't do anything, and then 72, they were back. So actually, there was a break there. But the factory didn't get involved until Janet Guthrie in 76, 77. Since then, I think Bryant Factory has been involved on cars, not every year. Sometimes it was actually called Bryant Heating and Cooling Special, and other years it was an associate sponsor. And then, golly, STP was around from 63 until on into, I think, with Jimmy Vassar in 94. I don't remember them being on a car after that. So I don't know if that would answer the question for you.
It does? Yeah, that's what I was kind of interested in those long-tenured sponsors. And again, I've heard Leader Card for years and years and years. What's the history? What exactly was Leader Card? And, you know, I know they sponsored cars for a long, long time, Bob Wilkie and everything else.
Yeah. Okay, Leader Cards was, at one time, they did computer cards or IBM cards, rather. They do greeting cards, although I've never seen one. Business cards, just anything card. We did a lengthy profile on them the other night, and my producer Scott Johnson has pointed out that I didn't finish the last caller's question on Tony Bettenhausen, so I probably ought to do that. There's a little bit of a tie-in in that Tony Bettenhausen Jr. did drive for Leader Cards in 88 in an attempt to get a car in the race. But Tony put together his own team, so I'm kind of trying to get this one done. And he did finish 7th as a rookie in 81, and then he was 10th in 87, and then 9th in 91. And normally would qualify the race and was very good about bringing it home. And very much the businessman. He was a lot more low-key than the Gary, but he was able to do a lot with little, and he put several teams together with a lot of supporters, and he would sell sponsorship shares to people, making no false pretenses about what they were or would not do. And he said, only get into this if you think that you can afford the money, because we could blow an engine and we're going to be done anyway. That's kind of a short version on Tony Bettenhausen. I'm sorry, I really didn't finish on the Leader Cards, but maybe we can get to that one tomorrow night, because we did do them a couple of weeks ago, and I'll be more than happy to do it again. But anyway, we do have to wrap up for now. We will be back tomorrow and on Friday from 7 till 8 on Network Indiana. We thank Brian Reinbold for allowing us to be in their garage, and to Matt Taylor for being the producer down at the studios and answering your calls when you called in. And then Scott Johnston, as ever, is the on-site producer. That's it for tonight. We'll talk to you tomorrow on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Good night, everybody.